Good morning. First of all, I want to express happy Women's History Month. It's March, all of March is Happy Women's Month. And I want to express my thanks to the ACCC, which is our community organization, the organizing committee, and Lubna Kutami, who actually started organizing the Arab Women's Conference 6 years ago, as well as Wiam Ghadwan, who's the chair, and the members of the committee and everybody who made this possible. Don't count this from my time. I want to also mention, I think this is the music, starting with the music, with the women musicians, with the music that was here was amazing. And I also think that what Aswad does, in terms of like addressing different parts of the Arab world and making sure that we think about different Arab countries, different Arab communities, Andalusia, past, present, it's beautiful. I think this is really great, and we cannot work without actually making sure that all aspects of our lives, politics, culture, economics, everything is together. So I think this is really wonderful. It's a great thing to follow. Okay, so I'm going to be addressing 3 points, and I'm going to put my phone in front of me so I can calculate the time. I'm going to speak about what are the definitions for Arab womanhood, not necessarily our definitions that are out there. How do we assess them? What do we think of them? Are they our own definitions? 3, what do we do about them? In other words, how do we arrive at our own understanding of our own reality and carve an alternative path vision on our terms? In academic terms, it would be, how do we live within empire? How do we defy the categories that try to put us in a box? And how do we come up with our own subversions on our own terms? In 1958, during the Algerian War of Liberation, France sent General Matou to Algeria to subdue the War of Liberation. For those who don't know, Algerians fought for 130 years for their anti-colonial struggle and lost 1.5 million martyrs. Relevant to our discussion today, General Matou, in May 1958, gathered Algerian women, domestic workers, in one yard and ordered them to take off their haik or veils. He thought that he will be liberating Algerian women. One example of the white man saving brown women from brown men. This is something that continues in our history in the sense of assuming colonial discourse is assuming that we are incapable and unable to define what's best for us, what our reality is, and how do we pursue our own liberation. The assumptions of the Arab woman as a docile woman and the Arab man as a vicious, bloodthirsty, misogynist, aggressive, violent man continue to haunt us and define how we can interact with our own reality, even as we try to escape that. During the Palestinian Intifada, and it's called the first, and I kind of question the question of first because there have been many intifadas, but the one from 1987 to 1993, Omni magazine suggested that Palestinian children go out and throw stones because their parents don't hug them. Palestinian children are grown prone to violence, Omni magazine argued, because their parents do not hug them. Other Israeli states people said, and I will quote, Palestinians use their children as human bombs and human shields. It's hard to believe how low the Palestinian terrorists are willing to stoop. They have no morals. This is Israeli battalion commander Colonel Guy. I wouldn't be surprised if the Palestinian terrorists attempted to dispatch pregnant women wearing explosive necks. Same guy. Dori Gore, former UN ambassador and advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, said, no matter how many times Israel learns of the use of children for suicide bombings, it's shocking on each occasion. Israelis do not understand how Palestinians are willing to sacrifice their own children in order to kill ours. And the list goes on and on and on. The assumption is that our parents do not take care of their children. The assumption is that Palestinian adults are cowards, and thus other adults, and we've heard this in many other contexts as well, and thus they send the children to do their work for them because they're cowards, they cannot go. The assumption, as far as women are concerned, is that we have something called motherhood deficiency, what I call motherhood deficiency, that our motherhood is deficient. It's as if it is part of our DNA. But we all remember, on September 30th, 2000, and those of you who are too young to remember may want to go and check the internet on that, the father of Muhammad al-Durra, trying to protect his son from Israeli bullets, coming at him bullet after bullet and after bullet, and the father is unable to protect his own son. I wanted to find out what's going on with this. I interviewed several mothers of fighters, of martyrs, and I want to share with you some of this research that I've done. I've spoken to the mother of Suad Srour. Suad was one of the members of a family who lost six children during the 1982 massacre in Sabra and Shatila. She was raped three times at three different checkpoints. And her mother said that if she had known, she would have gone herself to the checkpoint so her mother would not, her daughter would not be raped. I interviewed the mother of Dareen Abu Aisha from Beit Wazan. Dareen was a student at Najah University who has tried to go and do suicide bombing. In Arabic, we call it istishhadiyat. And istishhadiyah, it means it has an intentionality of actually trying to do something rather than just shaheed. You just get killed in the process and so on, to do something for her cause in order, because as we consider it, this is the weapons of the weak. And Dareen's mother, so Dareen tried to go and engage in a suicide bombing. She went first to Hamas. She was part of Hamas. At that time, Hamas, Islamic movement, was not sending women. So she went to Fatah. She switched allegiances, and they sent her. She was an honor student. She had five different awards. I interviewed her mother in Beit Wazan. And her mother, I said to her, did you know that she was going to? She said, of course not. I thought she was going to school. Said, well, what would you have done? She said, if I had known, I would have locked her in. I said, why? You don't want your children to participate in the struggle against occupation? She said, no, my children are not better than other children. They should participate. But she's my daughter. I didn't want her to get killed. I would have locked her in, make sure that she stays. In the first Intifada, women not only engage in popular education classes when Israel has closed all the schools to try to make our children ignorant, but they also pretended a lot of the times that the children who are being caught by the Israeli soldiers were their own children in order to be able to save them and rescue them. In Tell al-Za'atar, Palestinian mothers lost many, many children. And it raises a question for us to have a discussion around in terms of questions of reproductive health, reproductive rights, family planning, and so on. I interviewed Khadija Abu Ali from the Genuine Union of Palestinian Women about questions of reproductive health. And I said to her, well, what's happening with family planning in Palestine? And she said, you know, we used to talk to the women and tell them, well, you really need to get engaged in family planning. And then I went to Tell al-Za'atar of the Tell al-Za'atar massacre in 1976, and I saw Imam Muhammad. And Imam Muhammad said to me, you see, you wanted me to engage in family planning. I lost all seven of my children in the massacre. It raises a very interesting question. When a community is under genocide, what does the community do? And how does the community react when we talk about reproductive health and rights? Because in the United States, there is this discourse that if you are a progressive feminist woman, the only way you will do it is family planning. But this is not necessarily in all the cases. This applies to a certain very small segment, actually, of women in the United States. And mothers of Palestinian prisoners engage in hunger strike along with their children. We've seen that recently on TV. I don't intend to say or argue that there is something called natural about motherhood. I think you become a mother. A woman becomes a mother. There's nothing natural about it. But it definitely defies the logic of the Israeli and the colonial logic that assumes that there is something about our parenthood and motherhood that has some kind of element of deficiency that is inhuman, and what the Israelis are saying about that. Another model that we keep hearing about a lot in colonial discourses is the question of women's engagement in militant struggles. And again, I refer to the Palestinian movement. And the reason I refer to the Palestinian movement, not because I think Palestinians are exceptional to other Arab people or to other people around the world, but because this is my area of research, which I know about the most. We always hear the question, why do women participate in anti-colonial struggle, or in sometimes they say national struggle. I don't want to use the word national. We don't have time to get into this today. But it's always being presented as a problem. Nobody asks the question, why do men participate? It's always assumed that men should participate. But when women are participating, it's presented as a problem. And I think the fact of asking that question in itself is a colonial discourse. To ask that question, why wouldn't women participate? Actually, if women don't participate, we need to ask, or anybody doesn't participate who are subjected to colonialism, to settler colonialism, to violence, to curfews, to killing, to all the uprooting of olive trees, to everything, why don't they participate? That's the question that should be asked. Why shouldn't people participate? But the answer that we are given by colonial feminist discourses in particular is that, one, that Palestinian women and other women who participate, including Algerian women, I'll come back to that in a minute, are duped. They actually are not really feminist enough. They're not feminist enough. There is some kind of a measure for feminism that's out there that says what's a feminist and what is not. Two, that, or in other words, they have false consciousness, false feminist consciousness. Two, that they are seduced, as Robin Morgan argued in The Demon Lover, that they are seduced by the sexual prowess of the terrorist. That's another thing that's actually very prevalent, especially since the 9/11, 2001. It was before, but it became much more prevalent afterwards. Or three, as Andrea Dworkin argued in her article about Palestinian suicide bombers in Feminista, that they are opportunistic, that women only participate in suicide bombing either to cleanse their honor, because their families and honors that they lose because families are incestuous, that their fathers and brothers rape them. I mean, this is the kind of imagery that is propagated out there by very well-known and very respected feminists out there who are saying these things. Or in order for them opportunistically to achieve equality. They would not achieve equality unless they actually die, the same way that men die. Underneath it all is a reproduction of racism, Orientalism, Islamophobia, and Zionism. That basically argued that our society does not value women. Arlene Peck, for instance, in an article she wrote, she said that Arab men treat their farm animals better than they treat their women. Barbara Ehrenreich, who's a very well-known scholar and very respected in social justice circles, who should know better, because she wrote after Abu Ghraib scandal took place, and if those of you who don't know, we can have a discussion about it in the Q&A, after she found out that Lindsay England and other women, prisoner wardens, were actually engaged as much as the men in humiliating the Arab men prisoners. And at the time, it was said actually that this is Arab men are particularly sensitive to being naked, put naked, and like raped with each other and so on, as if other men are very happy about that. It's kind of like, but the way it gets constructed doesn't allow us to actually think that it's not exceptional to Arab men. Nobody likes that. No. Okay, but then she said after Abu Ghraib, she said, what Abu Ghraib taught me, she said that a womb is no basis for unity. So just because you're a woman doesn't mean that all women are going to come together. That's not enough of a basis for unity. We know that from our lives and so on. But she said, but then in 2005, this was in 2003, the article after Abu Ghraib scandal. In 2005, she comes out and she says that the best counter-terrorism strategy is feminism. And then she cites a woman named Carmen Bin Laden, who was married to one of the Bin Ladens. And she refers to her, she says that Carmen Bin Laden is looking at her bovine sisters-in-law. Bovine means cow. And there is a lot of references, a lot of the times, referring to Arab women in these kind of animalistic ways. And she should know better. In more recent times, Arab women have been presented in different ways. In Yemen, during the revolution, Ali Abdullah Saleh, the past president who was ousted, said that women who protest and scream outside in demonstrations are doing something that is against Islam. He said that their voices were awra. They're not, shouldn't be heard, and the best thing would be for them, if they were modest and respectful, is for them to go back home. And as a result of that, what women did is that they all went out in the streets, and even the parents who were a bit more hesitant about letting their daughters go, they said, go, because we want to show that we don't agree with this nonsense, and we are going to be participating. Other Arab women, and this is how women participate in defiance of these categories. Other Arab women like Samira Brahim, and I don't know how many of you know of Samira Brahim. How many of you know who Samira Brahim is? Okay. Samira Brahim is a young Egyptian woman from Upper Egypt, from Al-Sa'id. Her father belonged to Al-Jama'a Al-Islamiyya, Islamic group. And when she was protesting in Tahrir Square, she was picked up with a whole lot of other young Egyptian women and taken to SCAF, the Supreme Council of Military Armed Forces headquarters, and a virginity inspection was conducted on her. And you know, when something like this happens, a lot of people may not actually go out public with it because it's a very sensitive issue, but Samira Brahim sued SCAF. She went public, and there is a video on her on YouTube, and she basically spoke with the support of her father and her family. What's interesting about Samira are at least two things. One is that people always think that if you are part of an Islamist group, you will never go out and protest and so on, which again defies the logic that we are put in the box of a particular way of being thought of. Two, last week, Samira was disinvited from being honored by the United States State Department for Human Rights Award because she protested U.S. and Israeli complicity in violence against the Palestinians. But this is other ways of, and I want to go back now to Mathieu and what he did in Algeria. When he tried to save brown women from brown men by putting all the women domestic workers in one yard and asking them to take the veil because the assumption that the veil is the oppression, and we know, by now, we already know that this is not the case, and there's a lot of discussions about it, and I don't think we need to get into it, but if we need to, we can have a little discussion about that, but we know that's not the case. What happened is that because of the colonial ways in which women are perceived, that if she is wearing a veil, then she is not going to be, she's going to be docile and she needs to be saved. And if she looks European, then she is going to be like the French colonists and she's not going to participate in the movement. So what did Algerian women do? Some of them painted their hair blonde and were able to escape the Kasbah, which is the old city of Algiers, in order for them to go and engage in militant struggle against the French. Others continued to wear the veil and also escaped, because the assumptions of the colonists is also allows the colonized to protest and invent all sorts of ways to resist the colonization. So the stupidity of the colonizer enables the colonized, who don't have a whole lot of tools at our disposal. I mean, you know, a lot of the times people ask, why do Palestinian children throw stones? And a lot of mothers who wrote a letter to Queen Sylvia of Sweden, who said that, oh, the Palestinian mothers send their children to die. Same discourse as Omnia, as the Israeli government. They said to her, we would be very happy if we can take all the stones and all the guns and all the bombs and all the F-16s and all the Apache helicopters and all the weapons and throw them away. But there is no balance of forces in terms of the weapons of the weak and the weapons of the powerful, right? There is no balance of forces. There is no balance of forces between the two. But the weak, the people who want to be free, always find ways to resist. They are very resourceful, because when you want to be free and we want to have dignity, you find different ways to do it, and it defies the colonial logic. Under occupation as well, Israelis use sexual torture, specifically against, Palestinian women. At the beginning, 1967, after Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza, and there we started witnessing the contemporary Palestinian resistance movement, not many women will speak about it. Because it was a question of taboo to talk about, like, being raped and so on. After a while, there is a book by Kitty Warner called Land Before Honor. Palestinians started saying, al-ard wal al-ard, not al-ard wal al-ard, honor before, land before honor. And they started constructing a discourse that talks about sexual torture as torture. It's a form of violence. It's exactly like when we think about rape, we think of it as a form of power and violence. There is nothing sexual or something like intimate about it. It's a very violent way. It's a particular thing that happened to women and men and children as well. But they started talking about land before honor, al-ard wal al-ard. And later on, we know that there is a book that's written by a bunch of British women who put together testimonies of women political prisoners. There is a big testimony about Fatima Abu Bakra, who's a former prisoner from Gaza, who talks about what happened to her in prison. And this is what exposed the Israeli torturers and enabled a whole lot of other women to be able to kind of resist this and not confess under torture because of that. The second, another thing that happened during the first intifada is what we call the phenomena of iskat. Iskat means making one fall, or making one fall, basically, like, morally. And what the Israeli intelligence services used to do, and they actually also did that to queer activists, as we, if you watch the World Social Forum videos on the queer visions for Palestine, World Social Forum Free Palestine, Hanin Ma'aki speaks about that a lot, from Al-Qaws, Palestinian Queers for BDS, and talks about how is it that they threaten, the Israeli intelligence services threaten Palestinians by what they think would be taboo in their own society in order to extract either confessions or make them turn them into collaborators, making one fall, meaning making one fall from being part of the anti-colonial resistance movement into collaborating with the colonizers. And what women did, and I interviewed actually, a whole, I've heard about this first in 1903 when I was in Gaza interviewing a lot of women for my undergraduate thesis. And women started saying, we started saying to everybody, do not drink Coke or RC. So what do you mean? And they said that if you go, that we don't drink, because what will happen, that women will go to a hairdresser, and then maybe she's just taking off her, you know, top in order to put on the gown to get her haircut and so on, and then they will take compromising photos of her, and then they'll go visit her and threaten her. You know, you don't have to visit. They'll just say, you're being called to the military governor. You have to go. You don't have a choice. Or they'll come with a jeep and pick you up. And then they'll say, well, we have these pictures of you. You either collaborate with us or we're going to expose you. At the beginning, there were some young women who actually committed suicide as a result of what happened to them, because they didn't know how to confront this, because they were dealing also with it on an individual basis. Then when the women's committees, who were active in struggling against the Israeli occupation, realized that, they realized that we really need to have a strategy how to deal with this. So they started saying, we do not drink anything, don't drink Coke or RC. And I said, so, you know, what do you mean? She said, even if you go to your brother's house, you say, I'm fasting. And in Islam, if you are in Ramadan and you missed a few days because of menstruation or whatever, you make up the fasting afterwards. So if you say, I'm fasting, nobody's going to ask you why you're fasting. Nobody's like knowing, contest to that. And they would not do that in order for them to be able to resist these kind of strategies. So there is a lot of ways in which these women have actually come together to resist these various images. In Algeria, with Mathieu saying that take off the hijab, the Front of National Liberation, FLN, which was leading the struggle at the time, called on women to wear the hijab as a protest, as showing a way of distinction from the French colonists. Now, it's very interesting, because I don't know if everybody agrees that, you know, just wearing the hijab is the only way to do it. It should be a choice for a woman to wear or not to wear the hijab, not like everybody has to wear it. But there is a way in which the colonized adopt a ways of living that is very different from their colonizers. You want to distinguish yourself. You don't want to be like the colonizers, unless you want to pass the checkpoints where there are the soldiers, either Israeli soldiers, French soldiers, or whatever. Of course, after a while, it gets discovered. So in Palestine, for instance, after a lot of women started doing suicide bombing, they weren't allowed to go free through the checkpoint. So they will, as they asked the guys to lift their shirts to see if they were wearing a belt or something, they also started checking women. But it does work for a while, until somebody comes up with another strategy to do something different to be able to protest that. Now, colonial feminism does not only come from people who are identifiably come from the colonial camp, because we have something called native informants. And I think this is as dangerous, if not more dangerous, than the colonial feminism, because what it does is actually gives an authentic stamp and says, well, I'm a Palestinian, and I say 1, 2, 3. I think some of you may know about Ayan Hirzi Ali, the Somali woman who's going around talking about all the things that are wrong with you know, Islam, or Shad Manji from Canada, and so on. I want to give you a few examples of that. One of very damaging example was the Arab Human Development Report that came out in 2005. And the Arab Human Development Report was published, but it was sanctioned by UNDP, United Nations Development Program, but it was written by 200 Arab scholars from the region, from the Arab countries, not even those of us in diaspora, you know, like really authentic from the Arab world, quote unquote. And they basically reproduced many things of what the Bush administration at the time called for in their Middle East Partnership Program, MEPI, saying that the Arabs have deficit in education, the Arabs have deficit in gender equality, the Arabs have deficit in economy, they have deficit in 1, 2, 3, 4, and this is what, and the Arab Human Development Report reproduced a whole lot of these things, including the one that's on gender, on women's development and so on. And my critique of it, and I can share with you a lot of other critiques, Layla Abu Lughad and a whole bunch of people have written about that, and there is a lot of critique out there of it. But my own critique about that is that I think we need to rethink, how do we define what is women's gender justice? What is gender justice? Is gender justice being able to only be in public spaces? If public spaces have curfews, if there is a curfew, public space could be Tahrir Square, and the women insisting, and the men and the young people going there, and we're not going to go anywhere. We're going to be here until we can topple the dictatorship. But sometimes public space is not available. Sometimes you only have to get stuck in your home. And sometimes the home itself becomes a public space. It's no longer a private space, especially when the whole residents of one building get locked up in one room, and the one room has all these families from the building, that's no longer the private space of one particular family member. So I think we need to also think about, what do we think when we think about public? What do we think when we think about, is it the number of how many people are in public leaders or something? Because we know that Golda Meir, for instance, the former Israeli minister, prime minister, you know, she was a woman and she was the prime minister. She didn't do actually, as far as Israeli even women, Zionist Israeli women speak, she did not really do much for women anyway. Okay, or Indira Gandhi or Margaret Thatcher. Or Hillary Clinton, you know, we have a lot of examples of that. That's not enough to say the one woman got in there, because she did not get in there because of a struggle, of a collective struggle, of a movement, of a women's movement that says we really want to have gender justice on all sorts of bases. So I think this is big problem with the Arab Human Development Report. I'll come to that in 1 minute. But also, there is other ways in which, and I will share with you, I think, 2 more examples, and then I'll conclude, which would be fine with the time, right? Okay. One is that Amal Amire, who's a Palestinian scholar at American University, wrote an article, and it was, we were trying to think about, at that time, after 2001, after 9/11, 2001, we were trying to think, how do we educate more people about the cause of Arab women, about the cause of Muslim women, about what our issues are. We are sick and tired of always being asked to talk about the veil, about genital circumcision, about whatever, all these issues that this is the only thing that they want to talk about. We don't want to talk about that. We want to talk about other issues, but we can't talk about them, right? So we were trying to think about that, and we were thinking that if people only know, would that change what they think? Amal Amira took the book that Nawal Sa'dawi wrote, and I think many of you may know. It's called Al-Wajh Al-Ari Lil-Mar'a Al-Arabiya. Do people know about this book? A lot of us read it when we were like young, growing up in the Arab world and so on. It was like one of the feminist, you know, icons to read. But what happened with the book is that Gloria Steinem actually writes a foreword to it. If people don't know who Gloria Steinem is, she's one of the founders of the women's movement. She was a Playboy bunny, and she was one of the founders of Ms. Magazine, but she's also a very big-time Zionist and Islamophobe, which doesn't come out when they talk about her accolades, and now they're talking a lot about her. And I would invite you to actually look at the various statements that she makes and so on. But that sort of goes under the radar, which I think is our responsibility to expose and bring to the fore and say, if you are for justice for women, you have to be justice for Palestine, you have to be justice for people who are immigrants, you have to be for justice for everybody. But what the book happened, they took the book, the publishing house in Cambridge, Massachusetts, took the book, changed the title, Al-Wajh Al-Ari Lil-Mar'a Al-Arabiya, which is the naked face of the Arab woman, and made it the hidden faces of Eve. So there is no more Arab woman, it becomes a universal Eve. They took a big chapter that Sa'dawi has on colonialism and anti-colonial struggle and so on, and made it like a few pages. They took a few pages about female circumcision, because Nawal Sa'dawi was actually fighting against that in Egypt way before the West thought about it, and they said, okay, we're going to take the cause of African and Asian women to our own hearts, and we're going to be fighting for them, because they don't know how to fight for themselves, right? And they made that a whole chapter. So the book in itself comes to a point where it becomes a totally different product from what was intended. And from the message, so there is one message that we're trying to relay, the message becomes something different. And what happens with that, and the point that I'm trying to make about that is that a lot of the time, because we are already defined, we're already defined before we even enter the scene. The reason that we're having all these problems all the time, and I'm sure almost every one of you, if not every single one of you, has had different experiences. Every time you say who you are, you're going to be asked, oh, really? You say, I'm from the Arab world, something. Oh, must be really tough, right? You know, oh, how do you manage? They see a woman with hijab. It's like, I had a student who was an MA student at Michigan, and she wore the hijab and said, oh, good for you, because she was allowed to actually escape her community. We know this is not right. And I think this is part of also the discourses that we need to argue against, because we have a very prevalent discourse in our communities that talks about internal sexism and homophobia and external racism. We do not think that there is racism, sexism, homophobia, Islamophobia, and the bigger society and in our communities, because we're not immune. We don't live in a cocoon. We're part of this. There is no dichotomy between the two. This is very much part and parcel of the same thing. So to say that it's our community is especially racist or especially sexist or especially homophobic is not true. It's just not true. It is not, we're not more, better or worse than other communities. We are very much a product of our own conditions, of our own reality. In order for us to be able to kind of think out of this box, in order for us to be able to carve a different way of thinking of things, we need to think of something that I think people who know me already know that I'm broken record, the indivisibility of justice. The framework of the indivisibility of justice, that justice cannot be divided. You cannot be for justice for Palestine and be against justice against racism in the United States. You can't be against Islamophobia and support the exploitation of child labor. You can't be for children's rights and oppose women's rights. You cannot. It's impossible. And if people do that, we call it double standard in the past, but I think if we think about it as our own indivisibility of justice, we can actually construct it in positive terms. So I think this is the way we can think about things. In conclusion, I want to give a shout out. To all those women and all those men who came before us, who made something like this possible. Lubna spoke here. I'm sorry to put you on the spot, you and Imhode and your mother. But Lubna would not have been here had it not been for her grandmother and her mother, hadn't been active in something we established back in the 80s called the Union of Palestinian Women's Associations in North America. A lot of the women would not have been here had it not been for their families and for their parents opening up spaces for them. We're not here. We're weaving new threads, but some of the threads are not so new. Maybe we're recoloring them. Maybe we're dying, you know, we love like bright colors and so on. But this is where we need to think about the people who came before us. Im Nabil al-Kurd, who's in Sheikh Jarrah, 84-year-old woman, refuses to leave her house, and the settlers are living next door, and they keep throwing garbage at her, and she says, you know, I'm not going, and they beat her up, and she says, I'm not going, okay? Im Muhammad, who goes to the apartheid wall and sees a fashion shoot by an Israeli woman named Goldfine, who has set up a fashion house called Kom Il Fo to protest the wall by having fashion, this, you know, models against the wall protesting. And Muhammad says to the designer, she says to her, come join me and sit in. And the designer says, do you want to take a picture with me? And she says, no, I don't want to take a picture with you. I want to protest the wall. You cannot beautify something ugly as the apartheid wall, but we can join together. The colonized calling on the colonizer to join hands, despite all that the colonizer does to protest injustice, is feminist consciousness. Feminist consciousness is not just saying I'm a feminist and raising the banner. Feminist consciousness is a diversity of feminisms, is understanding where each one of us is at and respecting each other's choices and arguing and struggling and critiquing each other, because we don't have to agree. And we can yell and scream at each other and then go and have food together and break bread and continue to struggle with each other if we are all part of a community of the indivisibility of justice. Thank you.